Welcome to ArchaeoEd, a podcast about ancient civilizations in the Americas. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Barnhart, and I've been an archaeologist all around the Americas for over 20 years now. In this podcast, I'm going to talk about ancient civilizations that I find interesting. Sometimes it'll be overviews, sometimes it'll be very in-depth information. Basically anything I feel like talking about, because this is my podcast and I'm just having fun with it. I hope you enjoy it too. So, without further ado, sit back, relax, and let's get started. Episode 6. De Soto was a psycho. Many Americans think that the first contact between Europeans and indigenous people in North America was when the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. But that was 1620. Cortez had conquered the Aztecs a full 100 years earlier. By 1620, literally hundreds of incidents of contact had occurred all around the New World, though only a handful of them in what's now considered North America. And yes, I know, Mexico is technically North America. So let me qualify for you geography buffs out there that I'm talking about North America north of Mexico here. All right, just to get that straight. Anyway, the largest of the pre-Pilgrim expeditions into North America was led by Hernando de Soto from 1539 to 1542. For 3 years, he led an army of conquistadors through the southeastern part of the modern United States, starting in Florida and ending up in Louisiana. He encountered city after city with pyramids, palaces, and massive palisade walls. It was a patchwork of competing kingdoms, almost continuous settlement all along his entire route. They followed indigenous highways connecting communities of thousands of people each, with hundreds of finely built houses and abundant croplands. Today, De Soto's deeds are exalted all along his route. His name is on state parks, high schools, even whole towns. He's called a brave explorer and the discoverer of the Mississippi River. But I'm here to tell you that Hernando de Soto was a psycho. He and his men were murderers and rapists, thieves and liars. Their journey was no less than a reign of terror and destruction upon every community they encountered. Again and again, they took indigenous leaders hostage, ate all their food, raped their women, and enslaved their men. People who resisted were beaten, dismembered, burned at the stake, or sometimes ripped apart by their dogs as their loved ones watched. Slaves were put in chains and fitted with iron rings around their necks, forced to carry the army's gear until they died of exhaustion or starvation. There are few examples in human history where one group of people treated another so terribly. So, now you know my unvarnished opinion about De Soto, I guess I'll start the story of his journey. De Soto's decision to start in Florida was based on two expeditions that had landed there earlier, Ponce de Leon and Panfilo de Narvaez. Ponce de Leon had landed twice in 1513, ultimately killed by a poison arrow shot from a warrior of the Colusa Kingdom in southwest Florida. Narvaez was really the hang-in-there kitty of the conquistadors. He was the captain sent from Cuba to arrest Cortez and stop his conquest of the Aztecs in the 1520s. Instead, Cortez convinced his men to follow him instead, then poked out Narvaez's eye with a dagger and put him in jail, in Mexico, for 3 years. He finally got out and got back to Cuba, and then the crown gave him another chance, that being to explore La Florida, as Ponce de Leon had named it. So in 1528, he set out with 3 ships and 300 men, avoiding the bellicose Calusa kingdom by landing just north in Tampa Bay. He marched north through the swamps with great difficulties until he ran into the Apalachee kingdom, who frankly beat the tar out of him. His army fled to the coast just south of Tallahassee to meet their ships, but they never arrived. They built some poorly made boats while every day the Apalachee continued to attack them. They ran out of food and they resorted to eating their horses. Finally, when they boarded their boats, they sailed in the direction of Mexico along the coast. But the currents from the Mississippi River pushed all but a few of their boats way out to sea. Narvaez, sick and wounded, was one of those lost at sea. Cabeza de Vaca led the rest of the dwindling group, eventually arriving to Mexico 8 years later, one of only 4 men remaining of the original 300. De Soto would get to Florida in 1539, but that was not his first expedition. As a younger captain, he was with Pizarro on the conquest of the Inca Empire. In fact, he was the first Spaniard to meet Emperor Atahualpa. In 1532, Pizarro holed up in the town of Cajamarca as Atahualpa's 50,000-man army approached. He sent De Soto to lead a welcoming party to convince Atahualpa to meet Pizarro in Cajamarca as part of his insane plan to kidnap the emperor. De Soto wowed the emperor by doing horse tricks, trotting and circling and sprinting and such. He told him that they had many more horses waiting in Cajamarca. When Atahualpa marched in and got captured the next day, he was probably thinking about all those wonderful, rideable llamas that would soon be his. Of course, that didn't work out for him. Pizarro, with De Soto's help, conquered the Inca, and both men became insanely wealthy. De Soto returned to Spain in 1536. He joined high society and took a fancy wife. But what he really craved was his own glorious expedition. So, he convinced the crown to give him a governorship of Cuba and a 4-year permit to explore North America. So, with that brief background, I'll start to tell you the story of De Soto's expedition. I should say here that, aside from piecemeal archaeological reports, my knowledge of the expedition comes from 2 main sources, The Gentleman of Elvas and Garcilaso de la Vega. The Gentleman of Elvas was a Portuguese captain who was on the expedition and wrote his chronicle in 1557. The other is Garcilaso de la Vega, who was not on the expedition. He was, however, a fascinating historical character, sometimes called El Inca. He was the son of an Inca princess and a Spanish conquistador. He grew up in the royal court of Cusco, Peru, but then moved to Spain in his 20s. Later in life, he became a historian, and in his 60s, using various chronicles to write the story, he laid down the story of De Soto's expedition. It was called La Florida del Inca. It became a rave hit in Europe, and many copies were made. Scholars criticize it for being full of romantic inaccuracies, and indeed it was. There's even a scene where he blatantly plagiarized from Shakespeare's Henry V, published just 8 years earlier. But that romantic, pro-indigenous bent is kind of why I like it, and I'll be careful not to lean on it too heavily here. So back to De Soto. With the backing of the King of Spain and his own wealth, he collects an impressive force on Cuba. 9 ships, 620 men, 237 horses, 200 pigs, and a ton of gear. He even brought fine European furniture and a huge tent that he had custom made from Inca textiles. That tent, by the way, quickly molded and rotted in the humid Florida swamps. He had to ditch it early on. So he lands in May of 1539, right at the place where Narvaez did 11 years earlier, a town called Usita near Tampa Bay. But it was completely abandoned, evacuated actually. Fire pits were still smoking in the houses. The population clearly knew he was coming. At the town center was a pyramid with a palace complex on top, so big that it had its own defensive wall right there on top of the pyramid. De Soto had his fancy furniture hauled up and took up residence. He stayed for 6 weeks while scouts were sent out to assess the area, steal any corn crops they found, and look for locals to enslave as porters. To his surprise, they found a Spaniard among the natives, a man named Juan Ortiz, who had been shipwrecked 8 years earlier. He had been living among the locals and had learned the language. He would become key to De Soto's ability to convey his demands to the people of La Florida. Through Ortiz, he met the local lords, who wisely gave him servants from their communities and told him that the gold they sought was with the Apalachee people to the north. So, that's all he needed to hear. They packed up, and they headed north. Okay, this is a good moment for me to take a break, and when I return, we'll talk about De Soto's ugly encounter with the Apalachee Kingdom. The ancient Maya calendar. I'm fascinated by it, and though I've been studying it for decades, I still learn new things about it all the time. I call it ancient, but I and literally millions of modern Maya people are still tracking it into modern time. Towards that end, I've created two products to help people better understand it: my annual Maya wall calendar and an iPhone app called simply Maya Calendar. Through these tools, you can figure out today's date, or tomorrow's, or a Maya date thousands of years in the past. The app will even calculate your Maya birthday and tell you about your personality traits and destiny according to modern Maya daykeeper priests. The Maya Calendar app is available through iTunes, but both it and my annual Maya wall calendar are available through my website, mayan-calendar.com. That's Mayan with an N, -calendar.com. Check it out. All right, I'm back. All along his track through Central Florida, De Soto was met by local emissaries on the road with food and servants as tribute. No doubt word was sent ahead that their towns could be saved by facilitating his journey to the Apalachee territory. Smart, but way to throw your neighbors under the bus. The second he passed into a new territory, brutal sneak attacks started. Dead-eye archers hit the soldiers with oversized arrows from strong longbows, easily penetrating their armor. This infuriated De Soto, who responded by killing any Indio he could find, mostly not the warriors. He drowned some, burned others, and had his dogs tear a few apart. Shocked by his uncivilized tactics, they sent a party of nobles to negotiate a peace. But he took them hostage and demanded to be brought to their capital city. They brought him to a big city named Uzachili, a fine place surrounded by a palisade wall. Just outside the city, though, were waiting hundreds of hidden warriors. But De Soto saw it coming, and he slaughters all of them, too. No longer in a mood to negotiate, De Soto punishes the city by taking their homes, the food, and claiming the chief's pyramid-top palace as his own. He stayed for a month, so we have a good description of Uzachili. It had over 200 wood plank houses, many pyramids with elites living on top, public markets, sweat baths, and a canal system supplying all parts of the city with running water. It was really a very civilized place. When the city ran out of food, he enslaved over 100 citizens as porters and headed north to Apalachee. The Apalachee greet him in the same fashion, first with a rain of arrows and fierce attacks, But DeSoto, with his European tactics and technology, defeats them as well. He fights his way to their capital city, named Anhyka, and takes it as his winter camp. In fact, he stays 6 months there. The Apalachee attack again and again, but are met with brutal executions every time. DeSoto spends the winter searching the region, especially for gold, but he finds none. He estimates the Apalachee Kingdom, with many big cities, at about 100,000 people. His scouts find Mobile Bay, and he sends word back to his ships at Tampa Bay to resupply and meet him there the next winter in 1540. With his translator Ortiz's help, he finds a boy who speaks six languages. His name is Perico. Perico's not from Apalachee, but rather a kingdom well to the north called Cofiticachi. He says it's a huge place, a powerful kingdom led by a beautiful queen. He also says it has the shiny metals that DeSoto keeps talking about, and that's all DeSoto needed to hear. In April 1540, they saddle up, and with Perico as their guide, they head north into Georgia. At first, they run into even larger cities than the Apalachee had. The people were peaceful and dressed in clothing as nice as anything in Europe. Most of DeSoto's Uzachili slaves had already died from mistreatment, but these new people willingly gave him 800 people to carry his gear north. Again, smart move. But then they ran into a long patch of wilderness, no cities to raid for corn. And it goes on for weeks. Just as the men are starving to death, and DeSoto was ready to kill Perico for his deception, the queen of Cofiticachi shows up herself with a rescue party. She's carried on a big litter and accompanied by an entourage of hundreds carrying a feast for the strangers. She greets DeSoto warmly and gives him a big pearl necklace off her own neck. She leads DeSoto's army into her kingdom along formal roads and through a number of small towns to her capital city named Tlalimeco. Today, we know that that's located about 20 miles west of modern-day Columbia, South Carolina. It's a huge city, just like Perico said. Over 500 finely built houses, and the queen has a pyramid-top palace covered in beautiful textiles. DeSoto immediately asks for the yellow and white medals that he's after. The queen says she doesn't have them, but that she can get them, and she sends traders out. They return 3 days later, but it turns out to only be copper and mica. DeSoto is disappointed, and his men are downright angry. So, of course, they ransack the kingdom. DeSoto finds another pyramid with a temple covered in shells and pearls. Heavy double doors lead inside to 12 giant warrior statues, each holding a different kind of weapon and guarding coffins. Clearly, these people had warriors, but where were they? At the same time, his men fanned out to the villages and found something disturbing. Bodies of people who had died of some sort of plague piling up inside their temples. The queen confirmed this. The people had been dying in droves, and the kingdom was actually running out of food. DeSoto could care less. All he wanted was gold. So he decided to loot the coffins he found in the temples. Inside, among other treasures, he found European axes and glass beads. It was only then that the queen admitted that they were not the first Spaniards they had encountered. 10 years before, a group had landed on the coast, but then died. That was probably the failed colony of Luis Vazquez de Ayllon, last heard from in 1526. And that's probably what caused the plague, too. The scourge of European epidemics had already taken hold. DeSoto's men had already had enough and begged him to just stop and colonize Cofiticachi. It was a nice place and it was close to the coast. But DeSoto said no way. There were mountains to the west, and where there are mountains, there are gold mines. So, he takes the queen hostage and forces her to lead them to the west, a fine repayment for her kindness. This is where I really prefer De La Vega's romantic version of events. He writes that a brave slave from Georgia plots and successfully executes a rescue of the queen, running off in the middle of the night. He goes on to say that the queen fell in love with her savior, and that they were married back in Cofitacachi. That may not be true, but I want it to be. De Soto, undoubtedly pissed that he lost his royal hostage, nevertheless marches on to Tennessee and the Coosa Kingdom. By now, you know what happens. He kills everyone who opposes him, and takes over town after town looking for gold and finding none. He tells the local lords a story that he's been using since Appalachia, that he has a magic mirror that tells him the future, and that he can use it to know their attack plans before they even try. They spend the summer hopping from city to city, eating up all their corn, raping and pillaging, and of course looking for gold. But as winter approaches, De Soto turns south to meet his ships and resupply at Mobile Bay. And this is where he meets his match, King Tuscaloosa and the Atahachi Kingdom. At the border, they're met by an entourage led by a giant nobleman, almost 7 feet tall. He says that he's the son of King Tuscaloosa, sent to lead them to the capital for an audience. Led along well-maintained roads, the chronicles remark that the population is the largest they've seen yet, town after town of good size. They arrive to the capital, where Tuscaloosa stands on a balcony covered in furs and feathers. Tuscaloosa is even taller than his son, and at first makes a big show of authority. But then De Soto captures him with relative ease. In retrospect, I think his quick capitulation was part of Tuscaloosa's plan. He tells De Soto that they knew he was coming and that they had prepared a town full of gold and beautiful women for him. De Soto loved what he heard. Finally, some respect. Well, that's more like it. Tuscaloosa ordered his people to carry all of the army's equipment and led De Soto to a town called Mabila. Leading his small forward party of captains through the city's extra-fortified walls, De Soto followed Tuscaloosa to a reception hall where beautiful women danced for their pleasure. But then De Soto's guards noticed that there was no one in the city streets. Peeking into a house, they found it full of warriors. In fact, every house was full of warriors. It was an ambush. The alarm is sounded, and De Soto's party makes a hasty retreat out of the front doors. As they flee, they see Tuscaloosa's generously provided porters rush into the city with all their gear, and the heavy doors slam behind them. De Soto goes nuts. He sets the palisade on fire and shoots burning arrows into the city. They cut down anyone who runs out with their swords. Hours later, the battle is done and Mabila is in ashes. So are all of De Soto's belongings. Tuscaloosa may or may not have died, but he played De Soto, and De Soto's men knew it. What a military blunder. You always defend your supply line. It was October, and they weren't far from Mobile Bay, where the resupply ship would meet them. But De Soto knew that his men would abandon the army if they went there. So he made his worst decision of the entire expedition. They would not go to the ships. Instead, they would head northwest. Okay, this is the right moment for another commercial break. When I return, I'll enjoy explaining how De Soto's fortunes went from bad to worse. If you like the subject matter of this podcast, and clearly you do because you have to be at least 10 minutes in to hear this commercial, then I suggest you give the Great Courses a try. They're produced by The Teaching Company, a company who started over 30 years ago. They're kind of the OG of the autodidactic learning world. All those other online learning companies are really just copying what they started. They have hundreds of courses, not just individual lectures, but entire courses over every subject you could imagine. I myself have produced a few courses for them. They have this great new website called the Great Courses Plus. There you can stream audio or video all of their courses from any device you choose. Their website is www.greatcoursesplus.com. Check it out today and start your free trial. Okay, I'm back with more about Mad Dog DeSoto. Wounded and possessionless, DeSoto's army lingered at Mabila for about 3 weeks. Now it was November and getting cold. They wandered into Mississippi, raiding little towns for corn until they found another regional capital called Chickasha. They ran DeSoto's favorite play. They captured the town, DeSoto took the chief's pyramid palace as his own, and the army huddled in the smaller houses. For 4 winter months, the Chickasha chief sent them furs, meat, and firewood. But these were the Chickasaw people, who still survive today in Mississippi. They were no helpless victims. They made a plan, and just as DeSoto prepared to leave, they attacked. They snuck in at night, burning the Spanish houses and stables. DeSoto loses 57 horses, 400 of his 500 pigs, and 11 soldiers. Caught flat-footed, they decide to cut and run. DeSoto's new plan was to find the Rio Espirito Santo, the Spanish name for the Mississippi River. They knew it at its mouth in the Gulf, but not where it was inland. They do find the river, and the men rejoice. This could be their route to safety. A peaceful kingdom takes them in, gives them a town to occupy on the riverside, and even teaches them about eating catfish. Life is good for a moment. But their joy is short-lived. From the other shore appears hundreds of boats, a whole Mississippian navy. Red-painted warriors stand in each boat, shielding oarsmen. Bigger boats of 50-plus men carry local chiefs under canopies and banners. The Spanish crossbows prevent them from landing, but they come again the next day, and the next, and the next. For a month of daily naval attacks, they sit at the shore and they build janky sets of rafts. Eventually, the entire army uses the rafts to slip across the river in the middle of the night. A feat I really have to give them some credit for. That was probably pretty tricky. Once on the western shore, they immediately take over another walled city as their new base of operations. The local cities here are particularly distrusting of each other, and DeSoto weaves a bunch of lies and successfully pits them against each other instead of attacking him. He sends out scouts. He's hoping that they're near the Gulf, but to the south is just more river. The west becomes buffalo country, and the north has no gold, just more copper. Morale is at an all-time low. But DeSoto just doesn't know when to quit. His new plan? Make it all the way to the Pacific Ocean. So his men, now dressed in Indian clothing because their European clothes had been burned in multiple fires, saddled up and reluctantly rode west. As they left the Mississippi River Valley, the pyramid cities faded away and were replaced by scrubby little towns and campsites of semi-nomadic buffalo hunters. But these buffalo hunters had a particularly deadly form of resistance. They would hide in the tall grass with long pikes, and as DeSoto's horsemen would pass through, they would prop them up and spear the horses in the chest. After losing a number of his horses, the men begged DeSoto to return to the Mississippi. He finally agrees. They head southwest, and they take another pyramid city called Guachoya, right where the Arkansas and Mississippi rivers connect. He thought that now they must be close to the coast, but his scouts again say no. They start to build some more boats, but then another kingdom shows up with even more warships than before. They're called the Quigualham. They demand that DeSoto leave their lands immediately. DeSoto knows that his now ragtag group of soldiers are no match for this new enemy, so he decides to try to scare them with what might be his most psychotic thing he did in his entire expedition. He descends on an innocent town, burning it and killing everyone, women and children too, over 1,000 people. But that doesn't scare the Quigualham. In fact, it really pisses them off. The Spanish barricade themselves into Guachoya as the Quigualham attack. But then something totally unexpected happens. DeSoto dies. The chronicles say that he got depressed, then he got sick, then he suddenly died. Strange after all he had been through, but that's what happened. DeSoto had been telling all the natives that he was a god. His dead body was not going to be a good look. So in the cover of darkness, they wrapped up his body, tied some rocks to it, and sunk it in the river on May 21st, 1542. I've personally traveled around in the area where DeSoto died, and especially in the town of Lake Village, Arkansas, locals tell me that every couple of years, people show up saying that they found DeSoto's sword or his cross or some other possession. But thus far, none of those things have been authenticated. Regardless of where DeSoto's body went, he was gone, and now a man named Captain Moscoso was in charge. With the Quigualham swarming the river, he decided they should make a run for Mexico through Texas. But in just a few weeks, they found themselves in the hot Texas desert, no communities and no food for miles. Fearing death, Moscoso leads the army back to Guachoya, where they spend the winter building boats. None of the remaining men were trained shipbuilders, so their boats were neither nice nor easily maneuverable. To the contrary, the Quigualham, who waited for them in the river, were master paddlers. They rode circles around the Spaniards, who hid under wooden shields, and just tried to survive the relentless attacks. At some point, the Quigualham stopped their pursuit, but only to let the next downriver kingdom take a turn. A whole new navy of canoes attacked, most likely the Natchez nation. Entire Spanish boats went down, but then they finally made it out to the Gulf of Mexico. They arrived to Mexico on September 10, 1543, with only 311 of the 620 men who landed in Florida 4 years earlier. Honestly, it was a miracle that that many made it. What the DeSoto expedition documented was almost beyond belief, a patchwork of continuous kingdoms, hundreds of cities full of thousands of people each. Not just little camps with a few homes, big cities full of pyramids topped with elite homes and rich burials, canals, markets, miles of palisade walls surrounding entire communities. Collectively, an entire civilization of millions of people, not unlike what was going on in Europe, especially in the 1500s. And DeSoto effectively destroyed it all. He left every community he touched destroyed in his wake. The plague they witnessed in Cofitecachi was almost certainly a canary in the coal mine. Epidemic diseases almost certainly spread from there like wildfire. When the next waves of Europeans arrived, the capital cities like Talimaco and Atahachi were overgrown ruins. Their walls had fallen, and peasants were leaderless and eking out a living in their peripheries. Today, archaeologists call that civilization the Mississippians, and we struggle to find even remnants of their former glory. Heck, Most people living in America today don't even know they existed. But their ruins still do exist, and if you go looking for them, you'll find them. Ironically, some in places named things like DeSoto National Park. So, the next time you see a statue of DeSoto or a high school named after him, please join me in thinking, geez, that guy was a psycho. You've been listening to Archeo Ed, a podcast written, produced, and distributed by me, Ed Barnhart. If you liked what you heard, then subscribe, like, share, comment, and do all those other things that I'm supposed to ask you to do. If you didn't, then don't do any of that stuff. And if you really liked it, support Archeo Ed through my Patreon account. I make these podcasts for free, but I am not opposed to financial support. Until next time, thanks for listening. All rights reserved, copyright 2020.